We've been reading on Sunday mornings a very old letter written by the Apostle Paul to his friends at Philippi. There were some problems in the church, and this morning we begin at a place in the letter where Paul's strategy for dealing with those problems is clear. His introductory remarks are over. He's ready to get down to handling the difficulties. He says, "Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not only when I was there with you, but even more now that I am no longer there, work out your own salvation." In other words, take care of your problems, save yourselves from yourselves and the harm you may do to the church. Therefore, my beloved, that can be a very risky form of address. I have heard sleek evangelists say that with such glibness that I not only had no faith in the genuineness of feeling behind it, but I resented what seemed a false intimacy designed to be used for exploiting the audience. But somehow I am convinced that Paul meant it, that it came from some deep and costly regard for these people. And as I see it on the page, I am reminded how easily we forget the redemptive nature, the healing, redemptive nature of genuine love. It's odd that we would forget when it is proved to us almost every day, especially by children. In certain stages of growing up, they make themselves a nuisance to everybody. They obey grudgingly at best, and sometimes not at all. They live in a hall of mirrors and see only themselves, no matter which way they look. Every sound seems to be calling their name. What else is there? And then a day comes, finally, for most of them, when a new spirit takes possession of them. The love that has seemed wasted on them for so long begins to work. They remember how it patiently put up with them, how it trusted without much reward, and the recognition of such a love becomes a force inside them. Sometimes we simply call it growing up. Every parent knows what it means and the joy of it. I can remember how it began to happen in my sister and me. Once in a while, when our parents had to be gone in the evening, we would decide to wash the dishes and clean the house from front to back, simply for the joy of surprising them when they came back and having their delighted approval. We did that, I know now, because we knew, despite our complaints sometimes at discipline, how much we were loved. And once in a while, even then, that knowledge made us want to reciprocate. We all have to be loved by somebody before we are moved to love anybody outside ourselves. I once married two young people in a large Methodist church in Wichita a long time ago, perhaps the most strikingly beautiful pair I had ever seen. They would have graced the cover of any magazine. But within a year, their marriage was on the rocks, and as they discussed it, I found out that the young man simply did not comprehend the meaning of love at all. His parents had not loved each other. They had never demonstrated any love to him. And he had no idea what the emotion really included. We have to see love in action, giving itself away without payment, suffering because of indifference, before it strikes through our natural selfishness and causes us to grow up, by which I mean causes us to care deeply, sensitively, intelligently. Some parents, too many, I think, forget how essential their love is to a child and the tangible, touching proof of it. An unusually bright man in middle life told me in a talk not long ago that he still felt cheated, that his father had not demonstrated his love more often. He could remember one time, he said, when that had happened. His father walked out with him to his car and dropped his arm around his son's shoulder. "I can still feel the touch of his arm," he told me. "It was the only time I can ever remember his showing me any overt affection." One can forgive the father on the grounds that he perhaps had no such affection shown to him as a child, and so held his feelings inside, silent and untouching, but the cost to his own child was higher than he dreamed, as it is to any of us when we are denied what we need so much. Churches exist, I am convinced, despite all their troubles, because they offer love and caring inside a family larger than the one we grew up in. But the love offered has to be real, not just a matter of words spoken from the pulpit or used in an ad to get people to come. Gimmicks and gadgets won't do it if it isn't really there. I read a delightful paragraph the other day in a book by Annie Dillard called Teaching a Stone to Talk. It had to do with one of those artificial ways of proving affection. At least she thought it was artificial. And I'd like to share it. The new Episcopalian and Catholic liturgies include a segment called Passing the Peace. With her marvelous way of understatement, Annie Dillard says, many things can go wrong here. I know of one congregation in New York which fired its priest because he insisted on their passing the peace, which involved nothing more than shaking hands with your neighbors in the pew. The men and women of this small congregation had limits to their endurance. Passing the peace was beyond their limits. They could not endure shaking hands with people to whom they bore lifelong grudges. They fired the priest and found a new one sympathetic to their needs. The rubric for passing the peace requires that one shake hands with whoever is handy and say, "Peace be with you." The other responds, "Peace be with you." Every rare once in a while, someone responds simply, "Peace." Today, I was sitting beside two teenaged lugs with small mustaches. When it came time to pass the peace, I shook hands with one of the lugs and said, "Peace be with you." And he said, "Yeah." She wasn't a grouch or a cynic. She was there looking for affection, but what was happening seemed to her strained and artificial, too easily held in contempt by someone who really didn't care about it. Love, we want from our church, but in quiet and natural ways. I like to find things in my reading that restore my faith in genuine love and decency, and I found a note in the New Yorker the other day that helped. I had the same ambivalent feelings some of you had about the strike against Libya. And I was especially bothered, as an advocate of the Christian religion, that not much public regret was offered about the people we felt we had to kill. I expect that lack of feeling from a terrorist. I don't want it to be contagious. So I rather liked it when I read a small story about a note that appeared at the bottom of an inside page of the New York Times that told how a group of the American servicemen who made the attack and wished to remain anonymous issued a formal statement about those Libyans. We recognize that they are human beings, and we deeply regret that they had to be killed. The men who signed that letter had all, in some way or other, experienced in their own lives the redemptive power of love, and that moved them to say it. So Paul, who had felt it too, dares to say to these imperfect friends, "Therefore, my beloved," and then go on to compliment them for the way they used to act when he was present. A reminder that love is usually mediated through somebody's presence. We don't do very well with abstractions, at least not when we're young, and most of us never. I quite understand the little boy up in his attic bedroom, scared out of his wits by a thunderstorm one night, who, after being reassured by his mother that God would take care of him, said, "Well, you come up here and stay with God. I want to come down and sleep with my dad." We like a flesh and blood presence. Paul is in prison. As he writes, he can't offer his presence with the sound of his voice and the touch of his hand, so he asks them to obey the way they used to, even though he is absent. I don't know how they could have resisted. And then, because clearly some of them had been guilty of it, he wrote a timeless piece of advice about a common human failing. Do all things without grumbling, so that you may be God's children, shining like lights in a dark world. I got interested last week in the word grumbling. It's one of those onomatopoetic words in which the sound suggests the meaning. Words like hiss and buzz and mumble and hum. The last one, by the way, reminiscent of a story about a great old Harvard biologist who, in the early days of entomology, knew just about everything there was to know about bugs. The temptation to try to fool him was therefore irresistible, and one day two of his students decided to pull a joke on their learned friend. They caught a beetle and a grasshopper, took the wings from the grasshopper and carefully glued them to the back of the beetle, added some antennae that didn't belong, and brought their creation to the professor. Look what we've found. What is it? He looked at the thing, and then he looked at them very carefully for some time, and he asked, did you find it in a field where there was lots of grass? Yes, that's where we found it. And as you were out in the field, did it come flying along just above the level of the grass? They said, yes, that's just the way it was flying. And as it flew, did it make a humming noise? They said, yes, it did. And he said, well then, boys, I know what it is. It's a humbug. I could be in the northern part of Africa and my wife in the southern part, and her laugh would give her away. Grumble is one of those sounds equals sense words like hum. And as I thought about it a little more, I decided to go downstairs to my enormous volumes of the Oxford English Dictionary to see what kind of history that word has. I do very odd things at times under the influence of sermon making. The editors of the OED compared it with the French word grommeler, to mutter between the teeth. So, Billy being gone, I stood there and practiced it. And realized how I had heard myself do that, and how students do it in school, and once in a while even somebody in church. Paul is almost certainly remembering those famous grumblers who were led out of Egypt by Moses. They had grumbled in Egypt because they were there. When they got out, they grumbled because they were out and because they didn't have enough to eat. When they got the manna, they grumbled because there was no meat to go with it. They grumbled for 40 years. And when they got into the promised land, they were still grumbling. One of the most amazing and hilarious moments in Jewish scripture occurs when God says to Moses, you may find this hard to believe, but it is there, you go on with these people. I'd better not do it myself because I might just decide to get rid of the whole grumbling bunch. So says Paul to this troubled church, do what you have to do without grumbling. He knew it was one of those things that can become pathological. In every church, no matter how good, I suppose, there's likely to be someone who has become a habitual grumbler. Not infrequently, I think it may be the preacher who uses the pulpit to grumble. Nothing is ever right for the grumbler. Something is always the matter. I have sometimes taught Matthew Arnold's essays and poetry in seminars, and Matthew Arnold was a rather constant scold. I think he was never really happy again once he had left Oxford and had to go to work. And someone said when he heard that Arnold had died, poor Matthew, he won't like God. Grumbling shuts thanksgiving out of your life. And thanksgiving, gratitude, is the great antiseptic for the poisons we breathe in a world contaminated by fear and envy and hatred. I want to say a foolishly simple little thing to you. Forgive me, but it seems so important to me that I get possessed by the need to say it, even when it embarrasses me by its simplicity. If you want to be happy, look down at those who are not as lucky as you are and spend a lot of time counting your blessings. If you want to be miserable, look up at those who have more and feel envious. It's your choice, but it does work. Well, we've not had much grumbling in our brief church life, but I suppose we have our best chance for getting it right now. We're huddling again this morning around those drawings of the church down in Fellowship Hall, and no matter how hard we try, none of us will be completely satisfied with what we are able to do. We will have, I think, a charming building if we do it right, but it will not be grand. We've had to make some sacrifices about space. We won't have all the luxuries we'd like. There isn't an interest group among us, including this one, that will not have to make do with less than it would like to have. Maybe it's a good time to run across that line in Paul's letter. Do the things that have to be done without grumbling, and then you will shine in the world like bright stars because you are offering it the word of life. Thank you, Paul, for the reminder.